Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable panel for this Monday, October 27th. I'm Sarah LeDuc in for Joe Donahue. You can join the conversation this morning by emailing us panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And before I introduce the panelists, I want to try a sort of new thing where I'm going to tell you that our first topic is the food aid not being delivered on November 1st. There will be no SNAP benefits or food sent out. And I'm going to ask you if you want to email about that with your personal experiences and concerns. You can send that starting now, and then we'll talk about the topic, and then your letters will be in place, and we'll add your personal elements to the conversation. The panel email address, of course, is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Please do keep your letters short, to the point, and on topic. Don't include links or attachments, and if you have a sec to proofread before you send, that would be much appreciated. Thank you. panel@wamc.org. Our panel this morning, preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
Good morning. I am here and happy to be here. You know, you could just have your listeners ask ChatGPT to write it for them.
No.
Then, you know.
No. Roundly no. Roundly, soundly no. I don't like it.
I agree.
I know you did. I know you're kidding. I'm sorry for coming at you so hard because you were
okay.
Joking.
That's
and
right.
I should
it's
have
Monday.
Just laughed. Panel@wmc.org. That's Terry Gibson. We're also joined by Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College and President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Riedel. Hi, Karen. How are you?
Good morning. I'm happy to be here. Doing well.
Thank you for coming in. And political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. Hello, Libby.
Hello.
You haven't been here in a bit. People were missing you.
Well, yes, I know. I was here last Monday.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Right.
So easy to lose track.
I wasn't here
before
for
that.
A couple of weeks before there was a fun drive, and then I had to do some stuff. So, yeah. But it's nice to be back.
Early voting was open.
Yes. Early voting started Saturday. It runs through Sunday. The numbers have been tremendous. In Albany County, I get the report every night, and 63% Democrats coming out to vote, which is a good sign. I think that I think there are going to be a lot of races where people would think, oh, it's a shoo-in for the Republicans. Oh, you don't have to worry about it. Where there might be a closer or actual some upsets, because I think that there are people, both Dems and NOPs, who are sort of fed up with what's going on in Washington and don't like the direction of the country. And if members of the Republican Party aren't going to speak out about it, they can get punished for it at the polls.
Panel@wamc.org to join the conversation. As I mentioned a few moments ago, our first topic this morning is this latest effect of the government shutdown. The shutdown began on October 1st and is now the second longest on record. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has posted a notice on its website saying federal food aid will not go out until on November 1st, which is this coming Saturday. This is from the AP. While the Republican administration took steps leading up to the shutdown to ensure SNAP benefits were paid this month, October, the cutoff would expand the impact to a wider swath of Americans and some of those most in need unless a political resolution is found in just a few days. The administration blames Democrats, who say they will not agree to reopen the government until Republicans negotiate with them on extending expiring subsidies of the Affordable Care Act. Republicans say Democrats must first agree to reopen the government before negotiation. On Friday, New York Governor Kathy Hochul announced over $11 million in state funding for emergency food relief programs for hungry New Yorkers. On Friday, she published a letter to the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Brooke Rollins, urging the USDA to immediately release funds for food and aid recipients in November to prevent a public health crisis. Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey and other leaders in the area have also called on President Trump to continue SNAP benefits. It is a dire situation for many, many American families, and we need to discuss it this morning. Karen, let's begin with you.
Right, it's a tragic situation, right? And it's I have to say that I have also spent some time reading into which political party will be more harmed by the the situation, and it makes me sad to even think about it from this perspective, to think about it in terms of political moves and political advantages, because the impact of the SNAP program not being open to 1 in 8 Americans in New Mexico. In New Mexico, 25% of people in New Mexico depend on SNAP. Nearly 60% of SNAP benefits go to families with children. These are very real impacts. And I'm just troubled by discussions that focus on political benefits and political advantages when a system should really be about the people, we're at a bad place where our government just simply doesn't care for the neediest, the most vulnerable anymore.
Terry Gibson.
Well, we're definitely in a bad place, and my fear, trying to look ahead at where this is headed, and not really having a lot of optimism about the shutdown ending in any reasonable time to address this particular issue, is that Donald Trump has shown continually that he just wants to continue to divide the nation. That really is his focus. And he's also shown that he really wants to destroy the government. And I feel that he sees that the longer the shutdown goes on, that it benefits him to really rebuild the government in his name, literally in his name, and have sole control over everything, which more or less right now seems to be what is going on. And we're already seeing indications of how party registration or support for Donald Trump determines who gets assistance, who gets help, and who doesn't, regardless of what category it might be in. And I think for the food assistance program, what we may see in the near future is that Donald Trump will insist that the congressional Republicans somehow find a way to help him maneuver through the system, even if it's illegal, which we see happen all the time, to allow red states and states that supported him during the election to get food assistance, and that blue states will not. I think that's a very high possibility if both parties in Congress can't come together and get the government back on track, and if no Republicans are willing to really stand up to him in any numbers, and if the American people are not willing to take to the streets in such enormous numbers that we bring this all to an end ourselves. Otherwise, I think we're going to continue to see the political divide happen, and decisions will be made based on party registration in support of Donald Trump.
Some states have pledged to keep SNAP benefits flowing even if the federal program halts, as you've said, but there are questions about whether U.S. government directives may allow that to happen. The USDA memo also states that states would not be reimbursed for temporarily picking up the cost, and other states are telling SNAP recipients to be ready for the benefits to stop. Arkansas and Oklahoma, for example, are advising recipients to identify food pantries and other groups that help with food. Libby Post.
Well, you know, these people don't care. They just don't care. They have this perspective that SNAP goes to poor black people and not to poor white people. And they don't really care if poor black kids starve. The thing is, they're all going to starve. He is creating his own little famine if this is what happens. Throughout the country in deeply red states. If they look at the numbers, there's more red states on SNAP than there are blue states on SNAP. And there's a reason for that. Republican-controlled states, by and large, have the lowest per capita income. They have the lowest minimum wages and the worst schooling. You're going to end up with those kids and those families not getting the food they need. I mean, even Marjorie Taylor Greene is making noise about all of this stuff, recognizing. I mean, Terry, I understand what you're saying about him trying to figure out how to get the aid to the red states and not to the blue states. I think, there'll be lawsuits up the wazoo if they do that. And is it going to be enough? And what he's banking on is making things so bad that the Democrats feel compelled to come back to the table. But the latest polling shows there's a 7-point gap between the 50% of the people in the United States who, and this is a, I think it was an AP NORC poll.
I saw a Reuters Ipsos poll.
Yeah, that's what it was. Okay. Reuters Ipsos. 50%, but a NORC AP poll had the same numbers a couple weeks ago.
Sure.
50% of the people blame the Republicans. 43% of the people blame the Democrats. And, you know, you have 7% who can't make up their minds of what they're doing. But the fact of the matter is that it's going to hurt his own constituency. And as I said before, there's a lot of what we call NOPs, no party registration. Because the people are disaffected by both parties and they don't want to be defined by the label or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing a shift of some of those NOPs moving back to the center. We're not talking about moving to the left. We're talking about moving to the center. We're talking about maintaining the policies and the legacies that have built this country. You know, there's a reason why we have SNAP. There's a reason why we have aid to families with dependent children. It's a reason why we have all of those programs. It's to help people. And this administration is a bootstrap administration and doesn't care what their policies do to people. Because as I said last week, and some people poo-pooed me, they don't care if people die. They don't care if women bleed out in parking lots. They don't care if kids die of measles because of RFK Jr.'s new vaccination policies, which are just absurd. And they don't care if people die of starvation or cancer because they cut the cancer funding. All the things that they've done fly in the face of who we are as Americans.
Karen?
I'm done now.
I think there is, the discussion, both by Libby and Terry, just reiterate what I was trying to say. The debate, the political discourse is now about which political party will benefit from the tragedies that are coming our way. It's like these are the most vulnerable people in our society. It's a large segment of the society, and it's a large segment of our children, and they are being sacrificed for a system that is now catering to the interests of political parties rather than the interests of the people.
Mm-hmm. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. Catherine writes in and says, I work for a nonprofit agency in New York State. One of my clients gets SNAP benefits. She's a 68-year-old woman with disabilities, and I take her shopping every week. This will impact her negatively. Before that, I worked with young children with disabilities. Many of them came from poverty, and school was the only place they could get a warm meal. The current administration is set on destroying America, and the Republicans have no spines. That's from Catherine. We heard from Isla, who says, the Holodomor is what Stalin did to starve Ukraine. I may not have pronounced that correctly. If it does come to pass that this face-off continues and Trump rigs a way to add just the populations inclined to favor him, as long as they're not starving or seeing people falling apart around them due to Trump policies, it will be Trump's Holodomor. Excuse me. Perhaps these favored populations will be lifted up more by billionaire donations to Trump and Trump-aligned governors? Question mark. That's from Isla. And Zach says, let them not eat. Let the Republicans and all those who voted for Trump learn how many of them are actually on some form of government assistance. Let the good people of the, quote, red states realize that the culture war is not between left and right. It's between the haves and have-nots. Then we can all love and stop voting for radical rich Republicans. Libby is right, as always, says Zach. They simply do not care.
Well, thank you.
And Lori says,
you know, I wish that were...
Go ahead, Terry.
I wish that human nature worked that way, and I wish that what the letter writer is asking for there, I wish that that was possible. But to me, at least, history of the pain and suffering that Donald Trump's base has endured, especially in southern states, especially in poor states, it didn't just start with Donald Trump. They have been deprived a lot of opportunity, a lot of educational benefits, a lot of health benefits for decades and decades due to Republican measures to continually cut government, shrink government, cut taxes. And so they have shown an incredible tolerance for pain, not just with Donald Trump's election, but with many before that. And so I would like to think that there would be a point at which you would recognize that the people that you put in office are causing you harm, and therefore you should rebel against them and replace them. But I just haven't seen evidence that they work that way. And it's sad and it's disturbing. But I think it's going to take more than just that particular deprivation to activate his base in somehow a different direction.
Panel at WAMC.org. Lori writes in and says, SNAP doesn't cover all food expenses, i.e. no rotisserie chicken or prepared foods, and recipients don't receive enough money to cover their food needs each month. For example, my sister receives SNAP in the amount of $220 per month. Her grocery bill, if she's to have protein other than beans, is $75 per week, and that never includes paper products and cleaning supplies because SNAP doesn't cover these. In order for her to eat, I'll be picking up another job in order to pay for her groceries. That's from Lori. And we also heard from Savannah, who says, can we talk about the private donor that will pay for the military? Privatization of the military is terrifying and a step away from democracy. How can this not be the largest red flag in this dystopian reality we are living in? I think that's a good matter to discuss. So let me introduce that topic after we take World BBC News. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Our panelists this morning are preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, professor of government at Dutchess Community College and president of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Riedel, and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. We will speak with them more and take your letters from panel at WAMC.org after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc in for Joe Donahue. Our panelists this morning are Terry Gibson, Dr. Karen Riedel, and Libby Post. Before the break, we were discussing SNAP benefits, and we will continue to share your letters on that topic. But we also were prompted by a letter to mention the enormous donation from Timothy Mellon. Timothy Mellon, a reclusive billionaire and major financial backer of President Trump, is the anonymous private donor who gave $130 million to the U.S. government to help pay troops during the government shutdown, according to two people familiar with the matter. Mr. Trump announced the donation on Thursday night, but he declined to name the person who provided the funds, only calling him a patriot and a friend. But the two people who spoke on the condition of anonymity identified him as Mr. Mellon. Shortly after departing Washington on Friday, President Trump again declined to identify Mr. Mellon while talking to reporters aboard Air Force One. He only said the individual was a great American citizen and a substantial man. He didn't want publicity, Trump said. The point, of course, being that a private citizen has essentially funded the government for this month or less or something. Quite a departure. Terry, what do you think? Oh, I think you're muted.
It is very disturbing and at the same time, not surprising, because there are these supporters out there that, for reasons that are really hard for many of us to understand, are willing to continue to support everything that Donald Trump is doing, even though it just really disturbs and disgusts so many of us. I think we have to all kind of sit back and take pause of what it means to have an extra $130 million sitting around that you can just hand over to fund a military.
It's incomprehensible.
And knowing that as much money as that is, it still has real limits as to how far it can go. It doesn't come anywhere near providing the actual funding the military would need to survive at an effective rate for any period of time. And will Donald Trump call on others? I think the only optimism is that there probably are not enough wealthy individuals that are willing to do this to the numbers that would be needed to support the government that even Donald Trump would be happy operating. So at some point that tactic will also run dry. I do think the whole privatization concept though fits really well into Donald Trump's vision of America, because the more control he can have, the less he has to report to elected officials, the less he has to worry about being held accountable by anyone other than, I suppose, the corporate billionaires. It's more in line with his vision of total control.
Mr. Mellon is a wealthy banking heir and railroad magnate and a longtime backer of Mr. Trump. He gave tens of thousands of dollars to groups supporting the president's campaign and made a $50 million donation to a super PAC supporting President Trump, which was one of the largest single contributions ever disclosed in American politics. Libby.
Well, this just flies in the face of, we can't tax the wealthy now, doesn't it? Right. Is he going to get $130 million charitable tax write-off for doing this? Clearly, the wealthy can pay their fair share of taxes. If Andrew Mellon can write a $130 million check without it really being a bother because he's a billionaire with a B, not a millionaire with an M.
Karen?
I don't even know where to start, but let me start with the fact that even though money in politics in the United States has a totally different nature than money in politics in any other democracy to begin with, but we do still have an understanding that no individual should have an undue influence over our political decision making. Only at the level that if I want to support a candidate, the number that I can donate to that person's campaign is still limited. There's still this notion that no individual should have undue influences over our policymakers. Now, I'm particularly troubled when I hear anonymous donors, and thankfully the name came out right away, not that that's going to change anything. The ballroom is also financed by anonymous donors. They don't give money for no reason. They're getting something in return. And the fact that our president says we have anonymous donors and that's how things are paid for, that should be acceptable is incomprehensible to me. Where is Congress? Why is Congress not speaking out? But in terms of privatizing our military, may I just remind everyone that our military has been long privatized. In 2019, for example, the Brown University's Cost of War Project has established that there were 50% more contractors than troops in some of the core regions where we were still present in 2019, we were still in Afghanistan at the time, Iraq and 18 other countries. Our military has been privatized a long time ago. When the Iraq and Afghanistan war started, that's when we started relying on private contractors. And that is something that we oftentimes forget or maybe are not even aware of. So it's a broader discussion that we really need to have about a military that is privatized where we rely on contractors that are, who are not accountable to us, the people.
Russell.
That's an excellent point.
Go ahead,
that's
Terry.
A really excellent point. I'm so glad that was brought up. And it is it is important that we not forget that so many aspects of our government have already been privatized. And mm-hmm. and it's just an excellent point. I wanted to address this issue of contributions. I think one of the reasons you won't really see Congress on either side speak up too much about this is because both sides of the aisle benefit greatly from super PACs, which allow you to essentially create an anonymous donor system. So the political system for quite some time now has been based on large contributions from donors that are able to hide their names so that they're hard to find. But that's not news. It is just another part of our political system that really needs to be refined, the campaign finance system. Because, yes, the contributions to this ballroom, the contributions to the military, are nothing more than political contributions to an elected official. And they go above and beyond any current rules that are currently on the books. And since there's no real rules in the books regulating them, there's not really a way to stop it right now.
It does take it a step further, though, because super PACs, while they can accept unlimited amounts of money, and I think Libby will probably be better to talk about the loss, but you cannot use the money. Super PACs cannot use the money to support to donate to someone's campaign. They can use it to support or work against candidates, but by giving money directly to essentially the president. Who uses it? Yes, absolutely, for his political benefits. That is taking it a step further, and we're certainly, and if we allow for anonymous donors, I wouldn't even call this corruption anymore. It was way beyond.
No,
corruption.
It's pay for it's, play. Pay. It's that's what it is.
Pay to play. Yeah.
It's all pay to play.
panel at WAMC.org, Russ wrote in and said, I believe it was Terry who just mentioned that Americans seem to be willing to suffer Republican cuts for decades without pushback, but he failed to recognize that this is true in the current media climate, where conservative media are straight up misleading and mainstream media are afraid to identify reality out of fear of being labeled biased. Until mainstream media begin reporting reality, the situation will not improve. For example, when this segment was introduced this morning, it was mentioned that there was a note on the USDA website with the announcement of the loss of SNAP benefits, but we did not mention that that announcement blatantly and illegally violates the Hatch Act by calling out Democrats for causing a shutdown using Trump's own language.
It's true. I mean, I don't get it. You know, here we have Orrin Hatch, right? Major Republican in his day. You know, he's probably be thrown out of the party at this point, even though he was really pretty conservative. But he actually had a respect for the rule of law. And so the Hatch Act says you can't spend federal money at all on political partisan purposes. And that's exactly what they're doing. Somebody, I'm sure there's lawsuits pending. It'll go up to the Supreme Court. And, you know, are they going to ignore the Hatch Act? Or are they going to say, yeah, you can't do that? But by the time that case gets there, it's going to be too late for this. Not for other things, but for this. But I think Terry's point of, you know, this president and the Heritage Foundation and the people surrounding him want to privatize government so that they line their pockets is absolutely true. We see it with Blackwater. We've seen it with other contractors, especially the military contractors. You know, and it's true. That's all they're really concerned with. And the politics of all of this and their policies show they really don't care about anybody else or anything else except their bottom line.
Terry, do you want to address the current approach of media regarding this administration?
I was thinking I might say a few words if there was time.
There is. Go please go ahead.
I think that what was said about that is totally correct. I think it was the letter writer that mentioned this, that the whatever narrative you want to believe about what is going on both in the world and in our nation and in your local community, whatever it is you want to believe, you can find it in the media now. Somewhere there is a media platform that has created a vision of what you want to be true. And we see that more and more and more, more than we've ever seen it before. And so, yes, it is just another problematic piece of this puzzle that people can be deprived of food assistance. They can be deprived of an effective education. They can be deprived of healthcare benefits. They can be deprived of employment, but they can still be exposed to large that tell them that this is, first of all, someone else's fault, not the people that you elected, and that you don't really need to worry because we're going to find a way to solve this, and it's okay anyway because this is divine intervention, and we must all continue to support Donald Trump because that's what God wants. I mean, that narrative is out there. And so somehow that contributes to giving them strength to continue to believe that this is okay. I don't understand it. I don't claim to understand it. But it's clearly working, and it's clearly worked for quite some time now. And until we have a large enough media platform that's willing to tell the truth about everything, regardless of whatever punishment may come down from the Trump administration, we're going to continue to have an American public that's living under a delusion of what's really real.
Preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, on the panel this morning with Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College and President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Riedel, and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. You can join the conversation by emailing us panel at WAMC.org, and we will be back with more after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, here with Terry Gibson, Dr. Karen Riedel, and Libby Post. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. We're going to now talk about more issues of government spending. This from Reuters. As Republican and Democratic lawmakers trade blame for the U.S. government shutdown, some have begun to worry that the impasse is ceding their authority over federal spending to an increasingly assertive President Donald Trump. During the shutdown, the White House has frozen billions of dollars in funds meant for Democratic-led jurisdictions, sought to lay off thousands of federal workers, and shifted money around to guarantee that military personnel and gun-carrying law enforcement officers will not see their pay disrupted. Nonpartisan observers said that further marginalizes Congress at a time when Trump is already pushing the boundaries of presidential power in other areas like military action and international trade. The U.S. Constitution, we should note, assigns the power of the purse to Congress and not to the president. This is what we've been discussing this morning, but we'll talk about it more now. Though Democrats have framed the fight over health care costs, some have said they are reluctant to pass a spending bill without assurances that Trump will not simply ignore it, which does seem a possibility. Republicans have largely remained silent this year as Trump has unilaterally raised tariffs, taken military action, and shifted spending, actions that typically would be the domain of Congress. Some Republicans say they understand the concerns raised by the Democrats. With Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson keeping his chamber out of session and Senate Democrats unwilling to support a temporary spending bill, Republicans are concerned that the shutdown is preventing Congress from passing the detailed spending bills that fund government agencies in the current fiscal year. The fiscal year, of course, began on October 1st when the shutdown began. Let's continue talking about this. Libby. Karen.
I mean, you know, what more can we say? You know, let's be honest here, though. Mike Johnson is not calling Congress back because of this. He's calling Congress back because there's one lone Democrat who has, it's a woman who's, I don't remember her name, but she's a Democrat who won a special election in a red state,
yes.
Right? And if they swear her in, they have enough votes then to release the Epstein files. And that's what that's all about, really, more than anything else. They can say all they want, but that's really what not swearing that woman in and having government run. It's to protect Trump.
Karen?
Oh, that's where we're at, right?
Yeah.
It's like the idea of... checks and balances, separation of powers, it just doesn't seem to be at play right now. It's like it's when the OMB says that they can spend money that hasn't been authorized by Congress, right? And that we don't have to spend money that has been appropriated by Congress. At that point, you have to wonder what Congress's role is.
That's right.
Is Congress's number one role is the power of the purse. You're in control, and they are willingly handing it over to the president, who we will talk about tariffs, I'm assuming, I think has a questionable understanding of economics.
Panel at W. Go ahead, Terry.
People like Mike Johnson just seem to have this amazing faith that the American people are just somehow stupid and not able to like see through these things. And sometimes I just wonder if he's right. I don't know. It's disturbing. But watching Mike Johnson's evolution as a person who is willing to say ridiculous things has been one of the more surprising things to me, because he was always a conservative elected official, but he did not have a history of saying just ridiculous things that could so easily be fact-checked and proven wrong. He was out there on mainstream media just the other day saying that this person who has been elected, duly elected, should quit complaining about not being sworn in and get busy representing her constituents.
How can she?
She can't.
And I'm thinking, how many people just bought that and thought, yeah, right, absolutely, that's what you should do? How many people just took that bait and thought that that was true and not realize that you can't do anything until you're sworn in? The fact that he's willing to say that on national media and somehow think that he can get away with it just leads me to believe that he really does think he can get away with it. Because the things he's saying lately are just more and more ridiculous by the minute. The excuses that he makes for not bringing up the Epstein files, for instance, the excuses he makes for not swearing in this individual, the excuses he makes for not bringing back government, they're just more and more ridiculous. They hold no water. There's no logic there. The argument is completely flat. And yet he's still allowed to do it. So at some point you wonder, what is the level at which the American people will push back and say, no, we can't take this nonsense anymore? I think we're going to find out in the not too distant future.
Yeah.
We'll see.
I think we'll find out on Tuesday, which will be a precursor to 2026. But Mike Johnson already got what he wanted, and that was to outlaw abortion, to give the states the ability to outlaw abortion. That's what the Christian right wanted from this administration and this Supreme Court. And so they got what they wanted. And now he's like, okay, whatever you want, because I got what I want. And, you know, there really is this link, in my mind at any rate, that he will do Trump's bidding because Trump has stacked the court in a way that will benefit the politics of the Heritage Foundation, the radical Christian right, and not rational thinkers, that's for sure, and people who value individual rights and liberties.
Ken writes in to panel at WAMC.org and says, some members of Congress are just now beginning to cede their authority, question mark. I don't know if that's exactly what we asserted, but if we did imply that, apologies. He continues, Congress has ceded its authority to the executive branch in numerous increasing ways my entire life. Failing to effectively act on an undeclared war, extrajudicial killings, overreach of executive privilege, abdication of specifying what they mean in laws and regulatory powers, such as that presidents can undo each other in spite of the ostensible intention of legislation, not coming back to pass effective campaign finance legislation after Citizens United. We are where we are because of what came before. Rooting for it to be like our preferred version of what used to be will not fix this. Any reply to that letter?
He's right. Yeah.
Expand.
I think it's exponentially getting worse, right? And it's more open, and it's less hidden. There's less pretense that there is still congressional. Mm-hmm. Pushback, but that's what we're seeing now. But the writer is certainly right that this is certainly since the end of the Second World War, the Congress and at times when you look at history, you can explain why Congress has given the executive branch more powers, and as I guess as the global world economy has changed, presidents as the head of the nations have gotten more powers to shape the economy, for example, right? So it's over the course of history we've seen how presidents have of course grown in power. This is not how it was meant to be. I have no doubt that is not how the Constitution was meant to be, to have such an extraordinarily strong executive branch, but it's the Congress over time has empowered the executive more. But what clearly we're in a different stage now, where it's that shift is just not hidden anymore, whereas previous shifts could be explained logically, I just don't see the political value of it anymore. The listener is correct, but I clearly we're at a different stage now. And
well, the letter writer makes some really good points, and I agree with much of what the letter writer said. But there is some key differences in that many of the examples that the letter writer cited were examples of Congress passing legislation, convening and meeting and voting and passing legislation that, yes, gave the executive more power, that did all the various things that – or undid all the various things that the writer claimed. But it all happened through a legislative process. What's different now is that Congress is giving the executive branch power by just doing nothing. Mm-hmm. They're not passing any laws mm-hmm. to approve mm-hmm. that power. They're not passing any laws to strip that power, to change that power. They're not doing anything. They're letting the president, the executive, just do whatever he wants to do with zero legislative backing behind it, one way or the other. That's what's different now. And we're seeing every day that Donald Trump takes advantage of that more and more and more, and clearly sees a future just around the corner where he no longer needs Congress at all to do what he wants to do. And if Congress stays on this track, if the Republicans stay on this track, they are not going to be needed except for, you know, ceremonial purposes. And unless the Supreme Court decides to actually act like a court and pay attention to the Constitution and interpret it with some kind of actual logic, then they're not going to stop him either. So it's a really scary time to see this president go completely unchecked.
To that point, Kathy writes in and says, there's another aspect to the shutdown other than not swearing in the representative from Arizona. Trump doesn't want Congress in session. Without Congress, Trump has no oversight and he can get away with anything, including tearing down the East Wing.
He's a dictator. He wants to be... He's acting like a dictator. That's what he wants to be. He wants to be an authoritarian. He thinks he's God's gift to reality and the country, and he can do whatever he wants. And we have people in Congress, the Republicans in Congress, as long as they get their policy stuff done, they really don't care. It's really just that simple. I mean, and until people wake up, and hopefully not too late, you know, and if the Democrats take the House next year, despite all the gerrymandering shenanigans, I mean, because Democrats have been winning this year in red districts because people are fed up. And so we take back the House next year, it'll be a little more difficult for him to do what he wants to do. But just the same, we're dealing with a man who is, as far as I'm concerned, revels in racism, revels in his omnipotence, and is now openly talking about running for a third term.
Yes.
Which is really against the Constitution. There was an amendment done. It's one of the last ones that we did. Was, no, you can only run for 8 years and that's it. I mean, maybe he thinks, well, it has to be 8 years consecutively. But that's not what it says. It says 8 years, period, end of story. Two terms, that's the end of it. And so it'll be interesting because if he wants to do that, that means doing a constitutional amendment where two-thirds of the country has to vote to say, yes, you can run for another term, and the timing of it just really won't work that well for him.
You mean if he wants to do it legally? That's what's required for him to do it legally.
I get that. I mean, will there be secretaries of states and heads of boards of election who will allow him to be on the ballot, or is he just going to suspend elections, be the petty despot we all know that he is? Just continue his term.
Terry thinks that's where we're headed. As far as this program is concerned, we're headed to a regional newscast. The panel this morning, Terry Gibson, Dr. Karen Riedel, Libby Post. I'm Sarah LaDuke. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. Regional News with David Gustina is next. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, here with Preceptor in Public Speaking, Strategic Communications, and Public Relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College and President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Riedel, and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org, and we're going to turn our eyes north for a bit here to discuss the latest with Canada and U.S. relations. President Donald Trump said on Saturday, that he plans to hike tariffs on imports of Canadian goods by an extra 10% because of an anti-tariff television ad aired by the province of Ontario. The ad used the words of former President Ronald Reagan to criticize U.S. tariffs, angering Trump, who said he would end trade talks with Canada. Ontario Premier Doug Ford said he would pull the ad after the weekend. It ran Friday night during the first game of the World Series. This is a quote from President Trump. Their advertisement was to be taken down immediately, but they let it run last night during the World Series, knowing that it was a fraud. He said this aboard Air Force One on the way to Malaysia. Because of the serious misrepresentation of facts and hostile act, I am increasing the tariff on Canada by 10% over and above what they are paying now. It was not immediately clear when the 10% hike would come into effect, nor whether it would apply to all Canadian goods. Canada's economy has, of course, been hit hard by Trump's tariffs, and Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney has been trying to work with President Trump to lower them. More than three quarters of Canadian exports go to the U.S., and nearly $3.6 billion Canadian dollars, it's $2.7 billion U.S. worth of goods and services, cross the border daily. Many Canadian products have been hit with a 35% tariff, while steel and aluminum face rates of 50%, energy products have a lower rate of 10%, while other goods covered by the U.S.-Canada-Mexico agreement are exempt. That trade agreement is slated for review. Trump negotiated the deal in his first term, but has since soured on it. Trump and Carney will both attend the Association of Southeast Asian Nations summit in Malaysia, but Trump has told reporters traveling with him that he has no intention of meeting with Carney while there. Karen.
Again, it's extraordinary times, right? It's like that word that we find ourselves in.
So and the laugh is like a gallows laugh.
It really is.
Isn't this actually so funny?
So the irony, of course, is, and so the his claim is that the ad is aimed at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, which I think on November 5th will hear arguments on whether the tariffs that are invoke the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, right? I mean, that's the whole argument that that the president has the right to impose tariffs without congressional input because this is an economic emergency. Now, that's coming up at the Supreme Court on November 5th. He's relying on that to impose the tariffs on Canada right now based on an ad that accurately reflects a former president's statement on tariffs. And by the way, just as a reminder, based on the take of our country on the world economy since the end of the Second World War, tariffs are bad. And I'm hoping we're going to get to talk about discussions with China as well ourselves more clearly about how bad tariffs are and how they are backfiring and how they are making not just our economy weaker, but have just weakened our standing in the world and our ability to build on relationships with our friends, and Canada being the best of them, right? So it's ironically, it's invoking the IEEPA, the act that assumes that there is an emergency, economic emergency. Trump has probably undermined his position at the Supreme Court, because clearly an ad reflecting a former president's perspective on tariffs is not an emergency,
right? And not a fraud.
Yeah.
Importantly, it wasn't AI of Ronald Reagan. It was video, archival footage of President Reagan.
And that of a president who uses AI regularly to undermine political opponents.
You know, he's a little man with a major ego. And he doesn't want to be told anything that he doesn't want to be told. It's just that simple. He's got the thinnest skin of any politician I've ever, not that I've met him, but I've ever experienced. And, you know, he's not really made for this. He's not made for the rough and tumble of politics like this, unless, of course, he's the one spewing. Otherwise, if somebody spews back and makes a point like this ad did, he gets his knickers in a twist and just goes bonkers.
Right.
I could say something else, but he just
no
goes, yeah.
chill.
Right.
No
right,
cool.
Right. He doesn't
no
know
confidence.
How to like just.
I mean, confidence, but
yeah.
no.
He
no
just,
cool. No, no self-preservation as far as even seeming.
He takes the bait
calm.
Every single time.
Exactly.
He doesn't know how to take the bait. And, you know, for some people, for 30% of the country, they love it. Right. But for the rest of us, whether we voted for him or not, we're like, come on. Can you just act like an adult? and stop acting like a child. But this is who we have right now in the White House. And he wants, he's like a three-year-old, a petulant three-year-old.
Terry?
Yeah, well, I think the thin skin analogy is so true. I was thinking about back when I was in office and my colleagues and others since and even today. If you want to run for office in this country, mm-hmm. unfortunately, one of the things that comes with it is being able to withstand the political attacks that will inevitably be levied against you if you're running in a competitive election. And it can be brutal. But it is just part of the job, and you have to be able to withstand it. And what most politicians and candidates do is they try to get out in front of it, and they try to push back and explain what the reality is, explain what the truth is, or at least defend their decisions that they're being accused of making. What this president does, what this politician does, what this really thin-skinned politician does, is he just runs from it, and he claims that everything is fake, everything is false, and everybody's out to get him, and never even really attempts to defend anything. What he's not talking about, what he's not acknowledging, is the enormous amount of pain and suffering that his tariff policies are placing on the people of the United States, especially those bordering states that rely so heavily in that relationship with Canada, especially in those industries like steel, for instance, that rely so heavily on a relationship with Canada. It's amazing that even a small percentage of the American people are willing to just overlook the damage that's being wreaked on this country by his policies and listen to him somehow say that this commercial, which, by the way, I really have to hand it to Canada, whoever they hired to produce that commercial, was worth every penny. It's so well done, and it's such a clever public relations strategy. When they clearly need to do something for their own economic benefit, and it's so well done, it's so well targeted, and I think ultimately it's going to be effective to some degree, if not with the courts. I don't think it'll be effective in the courts, but I think it's certainly going to be effective with some segment of the American people that are seeing it. I know I'm talking here, but before I forget, at some point I do want to go back just to address a couple things that we left off with when we went to the commercial break about where we're headed with the election of Donald Trump illegally placing himself in office. I just had a couple of more things to say.
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. Jump right back to it. Go ahead.
I'm sorry to jump there, but
not at all.
I forget, I think a part of that is looking at this, what he's now doing of sending federal monitors to Virginia and New Jersey to monitor these mm-hmm. elections. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're going to see is that when Abigail Spanberger and Mikey Sherrill win the governor's races in those two states, two Democrats, and when Zohran Mamdani wins the mayor's race in New York City, you're going to immediately see this president say that those elections were rigged, that those elections were illegal. And he's going to point to some bogus federal study or data that they found through these monitors. And that is really kind of a test balloon to see if, when we get to the congressional races and Democrats begin to win Republican seats and mm-hmm. even Democratic seats, he's going to be able to point and say those are rigged. And by continuing to push this narrative that all elections are rigged, that don't go the way he wants, that's part of the path to put him into his third term, because he can begin to say that all of this stuff that's happening, it's rigged. It's not real. Therefore, I can continue to be president. That's what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
I hope that makes sense.
Of course it does. I mean, unfortunately,
sense, but...
it does. Mike writes in and says, regarding this as well, martial law will be imposed when this presidential term ends and he refuses to leave office, or Republicans manipulate the electoral process to keep congressional control of the House and select the president when insufficient electoral votes leave the next presidential election undecided. That's why U.S. military are being sent to and left in or might return to blue cities and states. The current domestic military incursions are tests during a time when the U.S. Supreme Court majority is pro-Trump and likely to rule that it's okay to put soldiers in blue states as presidential policy. Libby, Karen, Terry, on that letter?
You know, we're starting into the militarization of our government and martial law. I mean, you know, this is the kind of thing that Marcos did in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
you know, this is the kind of stuff that various small petty dictators do. The problem is that we're the biggest country in the world, or not, well, we're the one of the most strongest countries in the world with one of the biggest economies in the world. And it's all being used to benefit a very small portion of the population. But what Trump does well, and it's what speaks to his people, is he demonizes the other. This is all about race. I've been saying this for years now. He hates Barack Obama. The only reason he wants a Peace Prize is because Obama got one. You know, I remember the Washington Correspondents' Dinner when Obama did a speech and said, made fun of Trump, dropped the mic, literally, and you could see Trump's face. And that's what all this is. I mean, the presidential portraits aren't even on the walls anymore, supposedly in the White House. I mean, you know, he has, and then the East Wing is being demolished for absolutely no reason whatsoever. And how are they doing that in the midst of a government shutdown? What other big pocketed guy is paying for that?
That's private, right?
You know, in return for getting a big government contract for something. But we're dealing with, yes, this is unprecedented, but I do believe that we can overcome it as long as we stay focused, and that the Democrats don't create the largest circular firing squad that we have the potential to do in the 26 elections. We have to realize this is a center-right country. Right now it's center further right. We need to swing the pendulum back, and it usually does. But this is a center-right country. This is not, you know, this is not a socialist-leaning country. This is not even a far-left-leaning country. And if we want to take back the country and we want to take back the White House, we, the Democrats, need to come together and recognize the reality of the electorate and be able to speak to that electorate in a way that speaks to their interests and their needs. That's all.
Panel at WAMC.org to participate in the conversation. Let us now move to Asia to discuss incoming trade talks. China and American trade negotiators said on Sunday, this from the New York Times, that they had agreed to a framework of a deal on tariffs and other issues ahead of an expected meeting of the country's top leaders this week. China's top trade negotiator described the talks between the U.S. and China as candid and in-depth discussions on the trade deal, adding that the two sides had reached a preliminary consensus. The negotiators were in Kuala Lumpur for a meeting of the Association of Southeast Nations, where President Trump began a nearly week-long trip to Asia. He's expected to meet on Thursday with Xi Jinping, China's top leader, at a separate economic meeting in South Korea. The variety of issues discussed in Kuala Lumpur included bilateral trade, export controls, reciprocal tariff extensions, fentanyl-related tariffs, and cooperation on combating fentanyl trafficking, according to the Chinese side. A lot to keep an eye on throughout the week, but let's set it up this morning. Karen.
Mm-hmm. I think I want to use this discussion to go back to the beginning of the debates on tariffs. And my stance has always been, on this show as well, so I can demonstrate that that's always been the case, that the United States the Trump administration over, no, actually, I think the entire country assumed that the United States is stronger than we are. We underestimated China's powers, economic powers, the way we how heavily we rely on their resources, and how well equipped China was to push back. And I think that's important to remember that we really, our policymakers, did fully underestimate China's ability to withstand the pressure from the U.S. tariffs. Let me just, since 2018, China has taken active steps to build, they knew what was coming their way, and they built up. They started from the inside out to strengthen China, reminding China that they needed to buy China-produced products. They helped small businesses to prevent job losses. I mean, this is the power of governments that actually still allow to get involved in the economy when necessary, and they did that to strengthen domestic businesses. They also passed some laws which are fascinating, the anti-foreign sanctions law, for example, the export control laws, that give China the power to hit back at foreign countries and put international companies, like U.S. companies, in a tough position, because if they follow United States rules, they might break Chinese laws. And importantly, and this is something I focus on a lot, is that as a result of our policies, our tariff policies, we are strengthening other countries, specifically China, in their ability to build relationships with our allies. The China has recently started working a free trade agreement with Gulf Arab states, and notably has improved talks with the European Union, especially France, as the United States becomes a less credible trading partner. Our trading partners are going a different direction. Now, I do want to just, if I can just spend another minute on this, to me, an extraordinary situation that we're in because of our initial actions undermining the global trading system. China has what we need. The reason why we're now at the negotiation table is because China has the rare earth metals that we need for the production of cars, semiconductors, drones, factory robots, etc., etc. 90% of the rare earth metals are produced by China. Of course we need to work with them. They are an extraordinarily powerful position. And now, finally, one more thing I'm going to say is that China has become a pioneer in renewable resources. This is something that's been bugging me for years, that the United States has pulled back and focused on resources that are simply not sustainable. While this administration has decided to drill, baby, drill, in our wilderness that I personally would so love to preserve, and to produce energy sources that are simply the energy sources of the past, China has moved ahead with research and development of solar and wind energy sources. They produce 15% of the world's electricity, solar and wind have produced 15% of the world electricity in 2024 and account for 63% of the growth in electricity produced in 2019. We are falling behind. They're stepping ahead. And I'm devastated how this administration has undermined the standing of a country that has done in the past a lot of good.
Terry?
Well, it's hard to follow that summary of where things are. But that's a pretty good summary. Well, first of all, whatever we're seeing publicly in terms of Chinese negotiations is all. This would be the one exception to things being normal. What we always see in these situations ultimately is just theater. We see the executive performing and saying things in front of the microphone. We see the leader of the other country saying things in front of the microphone. It's all theater. What's really going on is happening behind the scenes in some room somewhere where the real decisions are being grinded out in a deliberative format. And we have no idea what the result of that's going to be. But it will probably be some kind of compromise that contradicts many of the claims that Donald Trump has made, because at some point there are economic realities that have to be faced, and we cannot just sever our relationships with every single country out there. So there's always going to be, if it was Donald Trump, the character saying ridiculous things to try to frame the narrative so that he always looks like the hero and everybody else is the bad person. But then there's going to be these compromises happening behind the scenes that where some economic progress is made. But I don't have confidence that it will be the type that we really need to survive this current economic challenge that we're in, which I think is going to get worse, because for the most part, Donald Trump has surrounded himself with people that kind of see the world as he wants them to see it. And it involves splashing and burning everything that really has been invented in this country for the better good for society in the last decade, whether it be scientific research or progress in wind and solar. So it's hard to see how this comes out on the positive side.
panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We are coming up against a BBC News break, and then we'll return to wrap up the show for this morning. Joining me, preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, professor of government at Dutchess Community College and president of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Riedel, and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. Again, the email address to participate in our conversation this morning is panel@wamc.org, and we will return after this. Welcome to the final segment of this morning's roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke here with Terry Gibson, Karen Riedel, and Libby Post. You can email us, panel@wamc.org. Before the break, we were discussing the trade talks that will take place in Asia this week. And I had a letter here. Here it is. Jay writes and says, how is the president allowed to travel with a shutdown, let alone any politician travel or with any politician? What do we think about that? What do we know about that? Is the president allowed to travel during a shutdown typically?
Well, I don't know, but I actually don't know. But I want to remind everyone that this is actually Congress should be doing its work. I think Congress should be doing its work of representing the people.
If there was any other president, I mean, we had shutdowns during the Obama terms. Mm-hmm. He didn't leave the country. He stayed in the White House negotiating to get the government back open. Period. End of story. This is all about looking like the hero on one hand and making the Democrats look like the enemy on the other. Because all they're doing, I mean, as we see on the U.S. government websites, all they're doing is blaming the Democrats, which, again, we talked about the Hatch Act already. I mean, it's a violation of the Hatch Act.
Right.
They're using public resources for partisan activities, and that's illegal. But that doesn't really matter to these folks, you know. And so, no, if it was any other president with a I don't want to say half a brain, but any other president with a sense of what it means to be president, what it really means to lead, he'd be in the White House doing his job, not flying to Asia. And he'll say, well, we're going to do this deal with China and blah, 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 blah. The deal with China will get done whether or not he's there.
John writes in and says, why are we sitting on the sidelines and letting the billions of dollars allocated for wind and solar production under the Biden administration go unused? Karen shrugs. Terry? Why are we doing that?
Well, is it going unused or has it been taken back so that we don't actually have access to it? I'm not clear on that.
We'll have that's homework for us, John. Mm-hmm. Thank you. We also, Libby, you mentioned in the break the military strikes on boats in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. They've impacted Trinidad and Tobago. The small island country of Trinidad and Tobago is in the middle of an American military buildup. The U.S. has deployed warships and attacked alleged drug boats nearby, leaving residents on edge.
To what end? To what end? Other than, oh, I can do this, you know, oh, let's play Risk, but for real, you know? And again, I don't care if I kill people, even if it's, mm-hmm. you know, unnecessary. We don't know if there were drugs in those boats. Those boats were sunk, I would take it, right? So who knows? And if there was coke in those boats, you know, it's all been dissolved because it went into the water. You know, I mean, come on. He's doing this for people to look at the shiny object over here. Look what I'm doing to protect American children. I'm blowing up boats that I think there are drugs on so that people won't recognize that they're not going to get their SNAP benefits. They're not going to get aid for children to defend dependent families. They're not going to get Medicaid. They're not, and their health insurance premiums are going to go not even through the roof of my house. They're going to go through the roof of the Empire State Building. That's how high they're going to go.
Since early September, President Trump has authorized military strikes on boats off the coast of Venezuela and in the Pacific Ocean, resulting in the deaths of at least 43 people. The administration has alleged the vessels had fentanyl on board, but has not presented public evidence of such claims. Democratic Senator Mark Kelly from Arizona said he and his fellow senators were presented with evidence that does not back up the administration's claims that the targeted boats in the Caribbean Sea are smuggling fentanyl into the U.S. Terry?
Well, I guess what's kind of amazing to me is that when we know our government in the past, since the beginning of our country, has taken part in military activity that was illegal, that killed innocent people. We've done that. We have to live with that part of our history, going all the way back to the way we treated the indigenous people here. But what's interesting about this case is that this president, because he believes that he's untouchable, he believes that he can literally do whatever he wants, he's just doing it right out in the public and admitting it and is touting it and promoting it and just using it as a big promotional campaign, not trying to hide anything, whether it's legal or illegal, even if it is illegal. And in fact, if it's illegal, all the better that it's illegal, because he thinks his base wants to see him break all the rules. It also seems to me, from an intelligence point of view, and I'm no military expert, but one of the benefits to doing it in secret would be that maybe you could capture some of the people on these boats and interrogate them and find out more information about the whole drug smuggling ring, if there really is one, and learn more about it. And actually, if you were serious about trying to end this drug situation, there would be a more intelligent way to go about it so that you learn who is behind it, the originators of it, and really target the actual place where it's resonating, not the poor little people that are supposedly transporting this in small little boats. None of it makes any sense from a logical point of view of actually trying to solve the problem. I don't think this is really a serious effort to solve the problem.
Karen?
Yeah, it certainly isn't a serious effort to solve the drug problem in the United States, certainly not the fentanyl problem, given that we are, as Libby said, the drugs that are coming from Venezuela are cocaine, and cocaine is not the issue at this moment. And I think we have to just be aware that the narratives that come out of this administration always come with an objective, but certainly the attacks on the boats have nothing to do with the war on drugs in the United States.
You have to wonder if he's doing this to take the emphasis away from fentanyl, right? Mm. And the pressure that all of that has put on the pharmaceutical companies and how that has undermined profits. You got to wonder. You just got to wonder. You know, there's so many things you can connect the dots to. And I am not a conspiracy theorist person, but you just have to think about these things.
But it is interesting that we are hearing from Republicans who are actually speaking out against what's happening there, and I guess it's largely it seems like mostly comes from the more isolationist Republicans who are concerned about the fear of entering yet another war. Certainly Venezuela's mm-hmm. leadership fears that this is the beginning of a war, which they don't want to see. But it is one topic where the Republican Party, there are members of the Republican Party who are concerned about this policy. So
Terry? It seems to be very much connected to Donald Trump's ego in terms of how he feels about President Maduro in Venezuela. There seems to be history there, and Donald Trump really does not like Maduro, and for reasons I don't really understand, because Maduro is actually sort of a classic model of what Donald Trump wants to be. He's managed to stay in office and get reelected in the most corrupt, unethical ways you can imagine. I mean, he literally was voted out of office in a legitimate election, and he's still there. And so he's doing all the things that Donald Trump really envisions doing. So I'm not really quite clear why he doesn't like him so much, except maybe he's just jealous that Maduro is able to get away with this and he's not. I'm not sure. But I believe it's really all about Donald Trump's ego and how he feels about Maduro. I don't think it really has anything to do with the drug situation.
Correct. It's all ego-driven, all of it. But he's best buddies with the guy in El Salvador, right? Who's also somewhat of a tyrant. But they play well together in the sandbox.
I think it depends on how they approach Trump himself, right?
Yeah.
Catherine writes into panel at WAMC.org and says, with regards to the boat strikes, we have to look more broadly and back in time, too. I believe the only justice is full accountability for all living U.S. presidents' extrajudicial killings. We have to demand that we be better in principle and not just get Trump for his poor style and open bias. Any reactions to that final letter of the show?
What's hard about this for the average American that wants there to be unity in the country, that wants the division to stop, that wants there to be some sense of normalcy brought back to our government, what's hard for all of that, for all of us, is that it's difficult to make any kind of progress when the leader of the country is openly declaring war on his own country, America, and openly saying that he hates his enemies and is openly taking vindictive actions, is openly making videos that literally show him dumping, human sewage on top of the American people. It's really hard to move forward when the leader of the country is determined to create division and stop any unity from happening. And that's what's unique about this moment, among many other things, is that in our lifetime, certainly, even the worst president, even what you might have thought was the worst president, never went to this level of public effort to try to openly divide the country and show how much hate he had against certain segments of it. Mm-hmm. There were people that maybe did it in secret. I mean, you could talk about Richard Nixon doing some things, but this is a whole new theatrical level that we have never seen, and it makes it difficult to move forward.
And we have to remember, and I have said this before, Richard Nixon, while what he did was horrible and he ended up resigning, there were members of Congress on both sides of the aisle who were World War II veterans and knew what it meant to fight fascism. We don't have that anymore. We don't teach what fascism means in our schools in a meaningful way. And so now we've just got lackeys in Congress. That's it.
Terry Gibson, Karen Riedel, Libby Post for the roundtable panel this morning. Thank you all, as ever, for your time and expertise. Appreciate you very much. You can continue reaching out to the show by emailing panel at WAMC.org as you wish, though it's better to email during the program, and maybe I oughtn't have given the email address just now. The roundtable continues after this.